It's okay if you aren't ready for kids right now. It's okay if you don't want to be a mom now or even ever. It's nobody's decision but yours. But do you know what's not okay? Not knowing how effective your birth control is. Talk to your doctor about effective birth control options so you can make an informed decision. Tap to learn more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. When 40-year-old Esther Castellani died a slow and agonizing death in 1965, the official cause was at first undetermined. The day after Esther's funeral, her husband Rene packed up his girlfriend Lolly, his daughter Janine, and Lolly's son Don in the company car and took off for Disneyland. If not for the doggedness of the doctor who treated Esther, Rene, then a charismatic and handsome radio personality, would have been free to marry Lolly, who was the station's pretty 20-something receptionist. Instead, Rene was charged with capital murder for poisoning his wife with arsenic-laced milkshakes. Murder by Milkshake is the compelling story of the Castellanis and of their daughter Janine, who was 11 at the time of her mother's murder and who clung to her father's innocence, even committing perjury during his trial. Rigorously researched and based on dozens of interviews with family, friends, and co-workers, Murder by Milkshake documents the sensational case that kept the city spellbound while providing a snapshot of the madmen-esque social and political realities of the 60s. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder by Milkshake, an astonishing true story of adultery, arsenic, and a charismatic killer. With my special guest, journalists, an author and crime historian, Eve Lazarus. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Eve Lazarus.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. But first off, tell us a little bit about your work as a crime historian, a journalist, and an author that put you in a position to write about this case initially, originally, before you decided to write this book. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you came in a position to be able to write this book. Tell us about the Crime Museum and your blog, and tell us all about that background, please.
Sure. I first heard about this case at the Vancouver Police Museum, and that would have been back in the 1990s. And it was a true crime display that was mainly at that stage focused on Rene Castellani, the murderer. And I thought, you know, it was kind of a really interesting, obviously bizarre case. And I'd written about it in my first book, At Home with History. And the idea behind that book was a house has a history or a genealogy like a person. And I was telling stories that happened in the house, filtered through the house. And I told the story of the Castellani murder you know, filtered through that Kerrisdale, Vancouver duplex where most of the poisoning took place. And it's been written about several times as a chapter in different people's books. And, you know, it's quite a well-known, or actually not as well-known as I thought after the book came out, but a fairly well-known murder case, of course, in Vancouver. And I really never thought about doing a book, but I did write, I have a blog called Every Place Has a Story, and several years ago I'd written up the story on my blog, again filtered through the duplex where the poisoning took place. And fortunately for me, I made a mistake. I said that Lolly, Renee's mistress, had a six-year-old daughter. And a little while later I got this note from a woman named Debbie Miller, and she said, "You're wrong. Lolly had a son, and he's my husband, Don. And he's been looking for Janine, the Castellani daughter, for almost 50 years. Do you know where she is?" And Janine was 11 when her father murdered her mother. And I'd always wondered what had happened to Janine. You know, what is someone's life like after something that awful happens? And didn't think much more about it. And then I'd written a book called Blood, Sweat and Fear in 2017, and I had the book launch back at the Vancouver Police Museum, and Janine came to my book launch and introduced herself. So I'd sort of met Janine, and I'd said to her, "Oh my God, I got, you know, an email from Debbie Miller, Don's husband, saying that he's been looking for you." And she got really emotional, and she said, "Wow, I've been looking for him for nearly 50 years as well." And I just got so intrigued by this story. I really wanted to tell the story from Janine's point of view, and really as much as possible try to give Esther back a voice in this whole story. And Janine, and she has two daughters now, and we met, many, many, many times. And she had a lot of the family album, you know, photos that you can see throughout the book. And I'd managed to get the testimony of the capital murder trial. And so the story, it's a bit different. It touches on the history of Vancouver in the 60s. It's definitely Janine's story. And in some ways, the murder became the least interesting part of writing this book for me.
Let's talk about the outline of the crime itself in July 1965. We can go back to previous about Esther's health, but take us back to the actual event, and let's talk about just previous to that, the living situation. You talk about Renee working at CKNW, popular radio station. Tell us about their family situation, that Janine with her father and her mother, Esther, she was living at that time in 1965.
Sure. Well, Renee was kind of a minor celebrity. He was a radio personality with CKNW out here in Vancouver, and he did all the promotions. And back then, probably even more so than now, ratings were just huge, and these stations would just do anything. You know, they kept dreaming up the most outrageous promotions possible, and he was well known for doing some of these crazy stunts. He was known as a dizzy dialer. It was kind of like a radio version of candid camera, where you'd call up someone and basically punk them on the air, and was known as a dizzy dialer. He did an outrageous promotion as the Maharaja of Alibaba, where the opposition station had brought up the guy that the host, whose name I can't remember right now, but he did a show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and they brought him up from the States, and he handed out, you know, wads of cash to people, and CKNW were desperate to come up with something, and they came up with this Maharaja of Alibaba, where they dressed up Renee in these sheik's robes and said he'd come to buy the province. And it was so convincing that people came out with signs saying, you know, keep BC British, as it was in those days, in the early 60s. And so he was getting quite a name for himself. He was, before that, he bounced around from job to job. He prepared, he was in the war as a radio operator in Second World War. He looked after washing machines. He was a maintenance guy. He had run a hotel up in Campbell River, northern BC, in the early 60s for a while. And they'd moved from house to house. It was a pretty unstable sort of life, but a fairly happy one, according to Janine, in the early years. And so they were bouncing around from sort of house to house. He'd finally got hired on after the Maharaja success. And so he was working full time, and Esther was working as a manager at a children's boutique in Kerrisdale, just where they lived. And Janine was going to the Little Flower Academy. It was a Catholic boarding school. So life was getting pretty good for them. And then Renee met and fell in love with Lolly, the 20-something, I think she was 25 at that point. She was a young widow, beautiful woman, had been left some money from her husband's earlier death. And I guess for Renee it looked like, you know, something that he could upgrade a younger wife, a younger, beautiful, rich wife. And he looked at how he could get rid of Esther and found arsenic. She loved milkshakes, apparently, especially ones from White Spot, vanilla milkshakes. And talking to various scientists, apparently milk and milkshakes in particular are a fantastic delivery system for arsenic because you can't taste it or see it. And it's a diabolically clever murder weapon. When it's given in small doses, it mimics natural causes like the flu or viruses, which is what they thought it was for many, many months. Esther had started getting sick when she'd found a letter in Rini's wallet signed Love Lolly, and confronted him about this, and he denied having an affair, but pretty soon after that started poisoning her. Do you want me to keep going?
Well, the thing is, you talk about this poisoning. What was, you write in the book about her Dr. Sector and his assessment of what was happening during that time of the poisoning. So tell us what he thought and what she thought. Did she suspect that there was anything afoul? What did the doctor suspect? What was his treatment?
Actually, I'm very angry at Dr. Sector, who's long dead now, but he was incredibly patronizing. Here she was really suffering, and she would go see him. I think she saw him 7 times, and each time he'd kind of pat her on the head and say, well, you're a bit plump, aren't you? Probably, you know, improve your diet. And he'd give her an antacid and sort of commiserate with her, you know, long-suffering husband. And off she'd go, thinking it was her own fault that she was getting sick. And as she got sicker and sicker, her family was so worried for her that they got another doctor, a specialist, to have a look at her. And he immediately put her into Vancouver General Hospital, where she was for 7 weeks before her death. She had over 120 different tests and was seen by several specialists, and no one could figure out what was wrong with her.
At this time, you write, and this is part of the incredible story, that this guy that would do anything for a promotional man that would do anything for a radio stunt to promote the radio station, while his wife was in the hospital, he cooked up an especially sensational promotional scheme. Tell us about this promotional with the Womack
that was
son.
And that also did him in the end, which was quite interesting. Yeah, one of the promotions was, or one of the clients for CKW was a car dealership on West Broadway here in Vancouver, and it was Womack. And Jimmy Patterson, who's got a zillionaire and owns Huff Canada, was originally working at this car dealership. He was a manager of it in 1959, and he had this neon sign built, and it was the biggest freestanding neon sign in North America at that time. And it was all lit up with these huge letters. It's still there. Unfortunately, now it's covered by a Toys R Us sign, but it's still there and huge. huge, but much bigger back then when buildings were very small. And the stunt was that Renee would climb to the top and live in a car until every last car on the dealership was sold. And they built scaffolding up next to the sign, and it was about, I guess, 40 foot high. And he would live in this car, and there was a sort of porta potty or something put up there, and they'd get his food up there, hoisted up, and people would wave and honk their horns, and they're encouraged to see him. So he's highly visible up on this sign, and he was up there for a total of 9 days. And while he was up there, Esther was in the hospital, and she got better and better. And the day after he came down, she got really, really sick and died not long after that. And after he was caught and everything came out, they were able to chart the amount of arsenic through her nails and through her hair that she'd ingested in a rough timeline of when she took it. And, you know, surprise, surprise, it coincided with the time that he was up on top of the BOMAC sign.
Yeah. Now, tell us about her death, and then we talked about the doggedness of this doctor, Moscovich. Tell us how he recognizes that there's something afoul, and what does he do as a result? And tell us about her actual death in 65.
Sure. Dr. Moscovich was the specialist that was brought in after Dr. Sector failed her miserably. And he'd had a put into hospital and had done the, as I mentioned, 120 tests and called in a whole bunch of different specialists to try and find out what was wrong with her. And to no avail, obviously, because she died. But he really liked Esther, and it just drove him nuts that he couldn't figure out what was wrong. And she'd had a hospital autopsy done just after her death, and that still didn't bring out a cause of death. And he just couldn't let it go. And he went back over everything, all the case notes, everything. And then he suddenly realized, aha, arsenic could cause these symptoms. And then, as now, you have to be tested specifically for arsenic. It just doesn't come up with any other test. And why would you, right? It was, you know, a popular way to off someone in 17 and 1800s, but it's virtually unheard of last century. And it was... From the autopsy, they'd had some of her organs still, and he'd sent those off to the city analyst to have them tested. And it came back that she'd had 1,500 times the normal amount of arsenic in her organs that were found in the, you know, human body. And so they had their sort of cause of death. And so you ask when she died. She died in July 1965 after spending 7 weeks in hospital.
Now, right away, of course, investigations might be different today, and certainly they were different then. But you write this incredible part of the story where he packs up his girlfriend, Lolly, his daughter, Janine, and her son, Don, and in the company car, and you write in the book, too, that he had prepared the radio station saying that he was going to use the company car for a family outing, certainly not what he ended up doing. So, and in this company car, he took off for Disneyland one day after the funeral. Tell us more about this suspicion that is aroused by this, and what do the police do? You talk about a particularly, again, dogged detective that suspects him early on. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, it was the day after the funeral, as you mentioned. He'd got the company car, and he had told, you know, the station, and he told the family that he was taking Janine away. He was taking her to Disneyland and to get away and make a fresh start of it. And they were quite encouraging. They loaned him a car for that, and the family gave him cash to, you know, take her away on a holiday. But, of course, he didn't tell anyone that he was also taking his mistress and her six-year-old son. And the other really bizarre thing that he did was before this, no one suspected him. He was a loving husband. He played the role really well. And the other, had he got her cremated, by the way, everything would have gone away.
Mm-hmm.
He would have got away with murder. But he didn't have her cremated for whatever reason. I think he just got really arrogant that he'd got away with the poisoning for so long and fooled all the specialists. And I imagine that he just felt invincible by this point and so could just do anything. And one of the other dumb things he did a couple of weeks before Esther died was he and Lolly went and took out a mortgage for a house in their new married names.
Oh.
Right. And then when the police found out about Disneyland and said, hello, he's, you know, got a mistress, and then found out about the mortgage, then they really centered their investigation on him. And by this time, they were all living together, he and Lolly and the two kids, in a house just outside Vancouver proper. And so that was all going along.
Right. You talk about that he eventually agrees to a search of the home. And what do police find under the sink?
Yeah, he. The police by this time, when they found out about all this, were really looking at him quite closely, and turned up one day and asked him if they could look inside his house. And another stupid thing he did was say, come on in. And they got really excited when they looked under the kitchen sink and found a can of Orthotriox. Orthotriox is about 90% arsenic, and it was a popular weed killer and a rat killer. Back then, arsenic was used for both. And they looked around the garden and saw that Rennie wasn't a gardener, and Janine has confirmed that her mother didn't garden either. So they got the can of Orthotriox and had it analysed, and it was missing about the same amount that would have been needed to kill Esther. Now, again, all of this is circumstantial evidence. They had no actual proof, but the circumstantial evidence was building rapidly.
Now, from there, what is their break? What is their impetus to be able to arrest Rennie for the murder of his wife? What does it take?
Well, they were, as mentioned, they were living together as a family then, and did so for the next several months. And then Rennie and Lolly took out a marriage license, and the police swooped because they knew that if they were married, that they couldn't force Lolly to testify against her husband.
Right.
So he was arrested straight away. They put off arresting him, I'm told, because they were hoping that he would do something really dumb and lead them to real evidence that they could charge him with, but he never did that.
What type of information did police believe that Lolly might have, and what did Lolly tell them, if anything, about Rennie and his plans? What did they get from her?
Not much. She never did testify at the court trials, and I'm not sure why that was, but she did testify at the inquest and pretty well lied. She was the problem for me. I believe she's still alive, but I couldn't find her. And I really don't know whether she was another victim of his or whether she was complicit in the murder. I get the sense that he told everyone he was getting the divorce except for his wife. And I suspect he originally told her the same thing. But after he was arrested, I mean, she must have known that he was responsible, you know, when they found out that Esther was murdered through arsenic. And she still stuck by him. And she then, Janine, after he went to jail, Janine stayed with her and Don for the next 5 years.
Now, you talk about that stay with her, and you write in the book, because, of course, you had this incredible access with the meeting with Janine. How did Lolly treat her, and what was the home life like with Don and herself? But also, what was the situation with Rennie in prison and Janine's relationship with Esther's parents, her grandparents? What did they say to her about both of them, and in real terms, what was the relationship with her grandparents after this?
Yeah, that was really awful, actually. She'd had a close relationship with her grandparents, Esther's mum and dad, before all this and while her mother was alive. And after Renee was convicted of capital murder, which at that point came with a death penalty, he still had custody of Janine. And he'd put over his custody to Janine to Lolly. So Lolly actually had custody of Janine. And so that was really bizarre, and he wouldn't let her see her grandparents. And he told Janine that they were going to kidnap her, that they were horrible people, that if she went anywhere near them, that she'd never see him again. And he had her basically manipulated and brainwashed into being really frightened of them. And so she wasn't allowed to see them and didn't for the next 5 years. And Lolly and Don became her only family. Don, she used to babysit a lot, and they were really close. And I was really interested about how Lolly treated her. I had a certain amount of sympathy for this woman. She was only 26. She had a six-year-old son. She was a widow. She'd been fired from CKW for having an affair with a senior manager while he kept his job, which I just find outrageous. And then she was financially responsible for this, you know, 13-year-old by that point, which can't have been great. But Janine never remembers her being mean to her. She said Lolly was very strict, but she was never mean. She threw a party at one point. And yet Don, her son, is estranged from his mother, so she's evil and believes she, you know, had something to do with it. So I have really mixed feelings about Lolly. And Janine stayed there for almost 5 years until Lolly dumped her father and found another man, and Janine was kind of taken and dropped off at Renee's sister's, had her name changed and told never to talk about it again.
Before that, before she was told never to talk about it again, what information did she have? What was she told in that ensuing 5 years, or even in the ensuing 2 years before she went to trial and testified? What did she know about the story itself? What was she told? Was she encouraged to get information? What did she actually know?
She completely believed her father was innocent. And she didn't see him for 2 years after he was arrested and put in jail. And he went through one trial and was convicted and given the death penalty. And they had no defense. They put on no defense. He didn't take the stand and didn't have any defense witnesses. And the second trial, he did take the stand, and so did Janine. And Janine was only 13 at that time. And she was basically told what to say. She committed perjury. When I got the transcripts, I was reading them back to her when I was doing the book, and I said, was this true? Was this part true? And she'd say, no, I was told to say that. You know, things like, you know, were Lolly and Renee sleeping together when you went to Disneyland? And they were, and she was told to say, no, they weren't. And, you know, awful, awful stuff to do to a child. And I think she, you know, I know that she's really bitter about that now. But she believed her father was innocent, and, you know, she had no one else. She'd been cut off from the rest of the family, living with Lolly and Don, hoping that her father...
It's okay if you aren't ready for kids right now. It's okay if you don't want to be a mom now or even ever. It's nobody's decision but yours. But do you know what's not okay? Not knowing how effective your birth control is. Talk to your doctor about effective birth control options so you can make an informed decision. Tap to learn more.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Mother would, you know, get out of jail. And this was also the first time that she'd seen him in 2 years. So it's just really awful.
She was the only, you write that incredibly, she was the only defense witness at the trial for her father and 13 years of age. And you said that when you got the trial transcripts then, and she hadn't seen it, you asked her questions, and like that, she told you that, well, the police told her to say that, no, my dad was not sleeping with Lolly when we went to Disney.
No, her lawyer. No, not
her
the
lawyer,
police,
pardon me.
Her lawyers. Yeah.
Pardon me, her lawyers, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this, what else was she coerced to say on that stand? And from your experience dealing with her, how traumatic was that experience for her among all the other traumatic experiences?
Well, I think I just mentioned that. It was incredibly traumatic. She's still very bitter about that.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Right. Now, with this living arrangement, you say that 5 years later, she is living with her dad's sister. And she has no contact with Dawn anymore or Lolly after that period of time. Am I correct?
Right.
What I found one of the most fascinating parts of this book is when you talk about the society at that time and the death penalty, when was he – tell us how close it was that he would have been hung for his crimes, and then what happens afterwards, which is, again, diametrically opposed to the death penalty.
Yeah, fascinating, actually. That was one of my most interesting parts of the book as well. When he was sentenced the second time to hang the death penalty was commuted 2 weeks before he was actually scheduled to hang, so he was incredibly lucky. And he got even luckier. You know, his sentence was obviously given life in prison, and he was sent to Maskwe, which was a brand new prison out in out past Abbotsford here in BC. And it was mainly for drug addicts and drug pushers, and he was one of the few that wasn't, you know, incarcerated because of drugs. And he was given just a huge amount of latitude. He was quickly, they had this grading system where he went through different grades, and when you got to grade 4, you were given certain liberties, like you could leave the cell door unlocked, you could go to the library yourself, and you could get out into the community. And so within a couple of years, this guy's gone from getting the death penalty to life in prison in this very, you know, Ocala prison, which is a very tough jail, to this pretty lax, it was medium security, but you know, compared to the others, it was, you know, a fairly nice place where they could actually see their family and Janine could visit him and, you know, hug him and stuff like that. There wasn't glass in between them. Then he could actually go out to the community. So within a couple of years, he'd got a volunteer job full-time with community services in Abbotsford, which meant he'd leave for work every day and then come back to jail that night. And he had full access to the community. I talked to people that knew him in those days, and he would be around. He was a very smart man and very good at promotions, and he did a lot of things for people and was incredibly popular and well-liked. And within probably 5 to 7 years, he was getting weekend passes. And Janine remembers him bringing a different woman around on weekends, or, you know, being asked to come and visit him at a different woman's place. And it was almost like these women were checking him out of jail for the weekend. Within 10 years, he was working for an Abbotsford radio station, and
wow.
He was fully paroled, remarried, moved to Nanaimo, where he worked for another radio startup station. And lived there for the rest of his life, which fortunately wasn't very long.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity, Eve, just to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. America has fallen in love with Best Fiends, the 5-star rated mobile puzzle game. Discover the world of Best Fiends and its cute characters in this fiendishly fun, free-to-download mobile puzzle game. Right away, I noticed the vivid colors and the impressive visual style of Best Fiends when I started playing this game. It's a really cool story, but I've stayed with this because it's the challenge and the puzzle solving that's kept me interested. There's 1,400 levels, and I am making progress all the time, but you don't need to be a gamer to enjoy playing this. I'm a novice, and I'm having a lot of fun. I'm really, really hooked on this game. Thousands of hours of gameplay, easy to learn, difficult to master. The perfect casual game to play alone or with family and friends. 5-star rated on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Over 90 million downloads globally. Play offline anywhere. Perfect when you want to squeeze in another level on the go or to play on a plane or in the subway. Don't miss out on the must-play game of the year. Solve thousands of puzzles, fun puzzles, and collect tons of cute characters. 5-star rated mobile game on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Download free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends, without the R, Best Fiends. Now, when we last spoke, we were talking about this incredible lax and lenient sentence. When he would have been a man hung for his crimes, he is now working with this, again, what in Canada we call a mandatory life sentence. He is working in the community on this temporary absence programs 2 years into his sentence, and as you write, 10 years, he is fully paroled. You write about in the book, though, there is a car accident that Janine is involved in, and then a settlement, and then a visit with her fiancé in prison. Tell us about this whole event that happens, that she's come into some money, and what the father has plans for that money and his relationship with her new fiancé, later her husband.
Right. At the second trial, on the night that he was convicted for capital murder and given the death sentence, Janine, of course, is living with Lolly, and she'd gone out that night, and she was crossing the road with a couple of friends. And it was a rainy, dark night, and she was hit by a police car and thrown into the air and almost killed. She had her right eyelid ripped off, and she had, you know, she was in hospital for a month and had to learn to walk again. It was just it was a tragic accident. It was a police car chasing someone, and he wasn't particularly speeding or anything, and just really awful all the way around. But she did get a settlement from the city, and was eligible when she turned 21. Well, Remy, for some reason, thought that he deserved part of this settlement and was just starting to harass her for the money. And I can't remember exactly how much it was. I think about $20,000 or something. Like, it wasn't a huge fortune by any means.
Mm-hmm.
But she'd at this time met her fiancé, Dale. And Dale had driven her out a few times to visit her father, because she was still going regularly. She still believed he was innocent. And Renee was starting to hassle her for the money, and Dale was starting to say, no, you're not going to give him any money. He doesn't deserve any money. And Renee was starting to really worry them both. He was starting to sent her a threatening letter. At one point, he'd asked her to sort of put her arms around his waist when she was visiting and pull on this string, and she got this note out. And when she got home, this note was all about how she was, you know, just turned into a pub crawler and and sort of no good, and he was, their fiance was awful and all of this stuff. And he would get out for on a weekend pass and come by their house, and she was really afraid that he would, you know, put a bomb or something in the car. It was really bizarre. And so she started to really, she went back and started to read all the articles about the trial and talk to people, talk to a family. And then she realized, oh my God, he really did murder my mother. And she cut off all contact. She actually never saw him again.
Right. Now, from this incredible research that you've done, you've read the trial transcripts, tell us how it seemed unusual that you would have access to the police reports in what is considered still an unsolved crime. Please explain that.
Oh, it's definitely not an unsolved crime. It's definitely a solved crime. I wouldn't have been able to get unsolved. So because it was a capital murder case and went with the death penalty, all the transcripts are in Ottawa, complete with the police investigation. So that was really useful, and a woman named Colleen Hardwick was going to do a movie, never eventuated, but had got all of this from Ottawa 25 years or so ago, and very generously loaned them all to me, so that was great. So I had access to all the transcripts, and I ordered up the inquest from Victoria, from BC Archives here. And the inquest always has an incredible amount of information, and hearsay information's allowed, and stuff that's just not allowed at the trial. So that was brilliant, and that's like 2 inches thick. So I was able to get a lot of the dialogue from the friends that knew Esther, and Reenie's own words and things from that, which I think sort of made it a bit more lively and interesting.
What was the reason for the inquest?
Well, they usually always, back then anyway, they would always have an inquest. If it was suspicious, it was at that point it was, you know, just to discover her cause of death and whether someone was responsible for it, not who was responsible, but you know, whether it was murder or suicide or natural causes. And it's a coroner's inquest that was held actually in the old police, where the police museum is today, was the old coroner's court. And that's also where she was, her body was brought when it was exhumed.
You write about the research used, that you spoke to many people, co-workers, people that worked with Renee before he was arrested, and then people that worked with him, like a radio station in Abbotsford afterwards. Tell us what they all said about his character and what they all said, weirdly enough, about his guilt.
Everyone I talked to really liked him. Everyone told me how smart he was, how clever, how much fun he was to work for. And in every case, I would say to them, well, do you think he did it? And every time, everyone said, oh, yeah. Everyone thought this guy did it, but they liked him anyway. I just found that fascinating. And there were a couple of things that I just couldn't answer, a couple of disconnects and things like that about why he did what he did and what he was like. And I had a woman named Heather Burke, and she's a forensic psychologist, and she was kind enough to go over the first draft and really look at him. And she said, wow, you know, he ticks off every box on the psychopath checklist. He's charismatic, he's smart, he was manipulative, just everything that on that list. And so I just found that really interesting. And as she said, you know, psychopaths are just quite fine until you get in their way. And of course, Esther got in his way, and later Janine did as well.
You talk about that he addressed the jury and made a speech to them that would be memorable. What did he say to the jury after the end of the second trial?
Right. The judge had gone through the spiel about, you know, may God have mercy on your soul, and he turned around and looked at the jury and really said that back to them. I can't remember the exact words offhand. Do you have it there?
He said to just have mercy, that God would have mercy on their souls, the jury.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. So he was pretty ballsy.
Yes. You talk about the effort that he does and seems to be successful in rebuilding his life and reputation. I find this especially interesting that he went from hanging to out in the community and being accepted in this same community, even though this crime was very high profile, and you say maybe not as many people knew about it, but at the time, this was well known. I find this odd that he was able to rehabilitate his reputation and his career. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, I talked to the guy, Bob Singleton, was the manager of the Abbotsford radio station that hired him. He was also on the board for Math Week.
It's okay if you aren't ready for kids right now. It's okay if you don't want to be a mom now or even ever. It's nobody's decision but yours. But do you know what's not okay? Not knowing how effective your birth control is. Talk to your doctor about effective birth control options so you can make an informed decision. Tap to learn more.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Prison. So he knew him from Maskwe, and he knew his, you know, reputation, and he hired him anyway. Hired him while he was still in jail. After community services, he went to the radio station where he went. He was known as Rini the Roadrunner, and he did all the traffic reports for the station.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a bit of a maintenance guy as well. He was good at fixing things. But Bob had said he really liked him. He had no qualms. He did a great job, apparently. But he said he did keep under the radar. Like, he didn't use his last name. He was in Abbotsford, which is, you know, a fair way out of Vancouver. I remember George Garrett, who was a reporter with CKNW for over 40 years, and knew Rini and Wally, actually, and he's still very much around. And George told me that it was a sister station, apparently, this Abbotsford radio station for CKNW. I mean, he was out there one day, I guess it was around the early 1970s. He said, I couldn't believe it when Renee came around the corner and said, "Hi, George, how are you?" He said, you know, he nearly fainted because he had no idea he was out of jail. So I suspect that most people didn't know.
Mm-hmm. You write about Janine finding out after the altercation with her father and the threats to her fiancé and her being criticized by him, and she started doing reading for the first time. You say family and friends, well, family, but friends had especially kept a lot of this information, and one way or another, she didn't know much, and she started to look at his guilt. What was, in talking to her and in this book, what was the process like for her to realize that the father had betrayed her, had deceived her, and that she had to move on? How did she do that? How was she able to cope with that reality?
Well, I think what she would say is that she didn't cope very well until this book. It was hugely important for her to have this story out. I remember when I'd finished the first draft of the book and sent it to her, and I was really worried, you know, because she didn't hold anything back for the book. Everything's in there. And some of it's pretty awful stuff, you know, including
right.
The time that she was raped. But she's really, you know, she was told to forget about it and not talk about it, and she didn't. And I think that's been festering for almost 50 years. And when the book, going through this process with me with the book, has been cathartic for her. And I think it's really helped her with the grieving process and to be able to acknowledge what's been done to her. And and go through it. And her two daughters have been incredibly supportive as well, as have a bunch of friends. And when we had the book launch, we must have had 250 people at the launch, and many of them were there to support Janine. And Janine got up on stage with me, and she'd never talked publicly before about it, and this was the first time, and she was amazing. We just sat and sort of like two women talking on stage and just talking about what it meant to her and what it had done to her. It's pretty powerful.
You write about, too, that and it was anticlimactic in the end, but it was very interesting that Janine picked it, was hesitant to tell her children about her past. But then what prompted her was, again, the police museum exhibit. Tell us what she did with the police exhibit in terms of sheltering her children, and then what she eventually, that event where she eventually told her children about her past.
Right. When her oldest daughter, Lindsay, was 12, the school were going to a visit to the police museum, and Janine had never been there and had no idea that the true crime exhibit was there. And a friend had sort of phoned her and said and told her about this and asked if she was aware of it. And Janine thought, oh, God, it's tomorrow. I really need to tell the kids this. I don't want them finding out that way, because they knew, you know, that her parents' names, and they'd seen photos of Esther, and she was, you know, of course, knew that they would recognize it straight away. So she called the curator of the museum and asked if he'd cover it, and which he did reluctantly, apparently, not sure why. And anyway, so they went to the museum, and when they came home, she'd taken the kids aside and just told them the story. And you know, they were incredibly supportive, even as really young children, and said, well, why would you be worried about this, Mum? It had nothing to do with you. And they've remained incredibly supportive. I think that's been huge for her.
Mm-hmm. You write about the trial as well, that the prosecution didn't just roll over. They tried to introduce things as ridiculous as that Esther's sister might have had an affair with Renee at some point. They did put on a very vigorous defense, didn't they?
The prosecution, the defense wasn't particularly rigorous, but the prosecution certainly were coming out with all guns blazing because they knew it was circumstantial at best. And it's quite possible, actually. I've got tapes of an interview or several interviews that were done with Esther's sister, Gloria, by a lady called Susan McNichol. She was going to write a book about 15 years ago, and ill health prevented her. And she incredibly generously gave me these tapes, which had Esther's sister's voice on them. And Gloria does say that she was called into the prosecution's office, actually, and asked if she'd had an affair with Renee. So the prosecution thought that that may have come up. And so the defense, I guess, had been trying to use that as an example, and she denied that. They also tried, Esther's sister Gloria had a lot of problems. She had been physically abused by family. Esther had as well. She'd been physically and sexually abused by her stepfather. So they had a lot of awful things happen to them in their young life. And Gloria was going through a divorce and was pretty messed up, had tried to kill herself a few times. And I guess the defense thought that she'd make a great patsy. And they tried to insinuate that she had tried to poison her sister, I guess because she was in love with Renee. And she'd been also out of the country for a long time while the poisoning was taking place. So that just sort of fell apart completely. But Janine was coaxed to say that she'd seen her aunt come round and make jello for her mother in the kitchen and shut the doors and stuff like that. So yeah, it was pretty insidious what they did.
You write that it didn't take long for the jury to deliberate and come back with the guilty conviction, did it?
no, not one at all. And there was no recommendation for mercy. Apparently one of the jurors told a reporter that they'd looked at it really closely because, you know, no one wanted to give someone the death penalty, but they couldn't find anything that would make them go easy on him.
How big a case was this in the media? You write
about it. God, it was huge. It was front page every day. It was insane. Like, people with everyone was talking about it around the water coolers, and it was just incredible gossip. I mean, it was so scandalous. It had so many elements in it, you know, the actual method of cause of death, and Reaney, who was so well known, and, you know, the beautiful mistress, and all of that. Yeah, it was really titillating for Vancouver. And it was also, one of the fascinating things for me about writing a book was the time that it took place. It was the 60s. So you've got Vancouver in 1965, still living in 1950 sensibilities, right, where, you know, drinking didn't happen and women wore frocks and everyone went to church and it was all, you know, very nice and all of that. But you're also seeing by the trial, 66, 67, when the two trials took place, this huge change where hippies are coming up and draft dodgers from the States, and there's Spain and there's free love and there's this whole just complete seismic shift in sensibility. So it was interesting sort of following that. And a lot of people think that because it was 1965 and still not quite, you know, still in this kind of 50s sort of thing, that he was convicted because of his affair rather than, you know, on any evidence. And even now when I talk to lawyers today saying, well, what do you think would happen if this happened now? It's still a toss-up whether he'd be convicted or not.
Really? Interesting. What was the reaction when he was, I mean, obviously it was known, when he was released after a couple years, was there any blowback from that, from the media? Was there any criticism of that decision?
Nothing. I didn't find a thing. And that might be because they just didn't know.
Wow. Yeah, that could be true. Now, with this, you write about, and I know that Janine has made her first public appearance at one of your book signings. You interview her. What about the relationship that was severed years ago for 40 or 50 years, Dawn Miller and herself, Janine? What was that reconciliation like, and what does it look like today?
That was one of the greatest things about writing the book for me, that they got back together. And it's just been really incredible. They've become really close. Their families are really close. They think of each other as, you know, long-lost brother and sister. Janine's daughter just got married a couple of weekends ago, and Don and Debbie were there at the wedding. And they're at the book launch, and they've been incredibly supportive as well. So, yeah, that was one of the really nice things to come out. And I think when I've been to lunch with them and stuff like that, and when you hear them talk and about the horrors that they went through, and Don's life wasn't particularly nice either, that you sort of look at them and think, oh my God, they turned out to be such nice, warm, wonderful people with great jobs and great families. And, you know, so that was a nice thing to at least find that out, that their lives had turned out okay despite all this.
Mm-hmm. When did Rene Castellani pass away, and what were the circumstances?
Karma. Karma got him in the end. He got pancreatic cancer not long after he'd remarried and moved to Abbotsford, and died of cancer in 1982. He was 56 years old.
Yeah, it's pretty young.
Mm.
What has this book, you talk about that public appearance with Janine. What was that like? You talk about it's overused word, cathartic event. But what has this done for her in terms of people knowing this story? You say that one of the intentions was to give her mother a voice. What does she think of this book? You did put the transcripts to her and then waited for her response. You say that was a nervous bit of time.
Yeah.
Well, what has this book done for her, and what has it done for her?
It's allowed her to grieve her mother finally.
And that's obviously very important.
Oh, my God, it's been huge. I think it's been life-changing.
And was it important to also, I mean, you talk about giving the mother a voice, but you do write in a book, and we didn't talk so much about it, but you talk about her being brave and courageous and also a unique woman, being a businesswoman and successful at that time in the 60s. So she was a remarkable woman, this Esther, and this is part of what this book does, is to talk about Esther and who she was at that time, and not, again, so much as it been, the focus on this charismatic killer husband.
Right. And, you know, that was one of the struggles that I had writing the book, because I had Janine's perspective of her mother, but she was 11 years old when she died. So, you know, it's from a small child. Most of the people, Esther's sister, Gloria, is still alive, but not in good shape, and I couldn't talk to her. And she's still really upset about the whole thing, so it's not an easy subject for her. I couldn't find any of her colleagues or friends that were still alive that could sort of help round her out as an adult. So that was hard, and I had to rely a lot on the transcripts and police reports of these people that were giving evidence about her and talking about what she'd told them and things like that to try to give her a voice there.
Now, with this, you met Janine at the Blood, Sweat, and Fear book signing that you were talking about this book, and you met her at the police museum. I wanted to ask you about all of the things that you're doing now. I read that you were planning a series of podcasts, maybe you can explain it better than I, about what your plans are for Murder by Milkshake, with a podcast series that you've done previously with other work that you've done. Tell us a little bit about that, and tell us about that.
Sure. I've started a podcast a couple of months ago based on my book, Blood, Sweat, and Fear. And the book was about Inspector Vance. He was the first forensic scientist, really one of the earliest in North America. And he worked for the Vancouver Police Department out of the building, which is now the Vancouver Police Museum. And a lot of his lab is still intact. It's amazing. He retired in 1949, so, you know, it's a pretty incredible feat. And as part of that, when I was doing the research, I found a lot of his grandchildren. He died in 65 and uncovered these boxes that he'd packed up when he retired, and was full of crime scene information and even his diary. So it became a fascinating book to write, and each chapter follows a different case, mainly murders, that Vance worked on. So it became sort of a natural for a podcast. And I've published 7 episodes of that, Blood, Sweat, and Fear, now. And that's been a lot of fun. But as you know, there's a huge learning curve to when you haven't done this before. And I'm hosting, I'm producing, I had to learn all the editing software and all of that. So I'm just starting now to introduce interviews with lawyers and police officials and things like that. And I'm just having so much fun with it. It's been amazing. And yeah, I'd like to, another book I wrote was Cold Case Vancouver, all about unsolved murders in Vancouver. So that'll be my next one. And I'd like to work up to Murder by Milkshake. I think it would make, you know, with Janine, to do that with her, would make an incredible podcast as well. The book has been optioned for movie or TV rights and documentary.
Congratulations.
So thank you so much, yeah. And so I also don't want to do anything, though, to negatively affect that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I want to thank you for coming on and talking about your book, Murder by Milkshake, an astonishing true story of adultery, arsenic, and a charismatic killer. For those that might want to take a look at your other work, your blog, this podcast that we talked about, do you have a website, Facebook page? Tell us about that, please.
Yes, all through my name, evelazarus.com. That's EveLazarus. ARUS. My blog, Every Place Has a Story, which is a kind of call it heritage, history and murder. And my podcast is all through that. My podcast is on Podbean, but can be accessed through that and through Apple and all the usual podcatchers.
Yes, absolutely.
And all my books thank are you listed very... there as well. Sorry.
Oh, thank you. That's great. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about Murder by Milkshake. It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Eve Lazarus.
Oh,
you have a great
pleasure.
Evening.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye. Bye-bye.
It's okay if you aren't ready for kids right now. It's okay if you don't want to be a mom now or even ever. It's nobody's decision but yours. But do you know what's not okay? Not knowing how effective your birth control is. Talk to your doctor about effective birth control options so you can make an informed decision. Tap to learn more.